it's Caitlin from C-SPAN. Did you know that C-SPAN has been serving the American people for 45 years? Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners. And now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45. Your contribution helps to ensure that we can continue to provide unfiltered, complete coverage of government proceedings on TV, online, on radio, and our mobile app, as well as context through newsletters, social media, and podcasts. Join us in preserving this legacy of access to the democratic process. Make your tax-deductible donation today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Professor Stephen Kahn, The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't, is your book. The opening line in that book is, "A book about rural America is preposterous on its face." What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what I mean is that, in fact, we use rural to describe vastly different parts of this country. There is no really good definition of it. And rural America, when you drill down, turns out to be a remarkably diverse label to cover all kinds of different areas of the country. We're talking about, you know, the grain belt in the Great Plains, but we're talking about timber areas in northern Maine. We're talking about parts of Appalachia, which were once upon a time coal country. We're talking about vast swaths of the American Southwest. All of these things get labeled rural, but of course they're dramatically different in all kinds of ways.
For the purposes of your book, how do you define it?
Well, I very studiously avoided trying to define it, because one of the things I found interesting when I jumped into this project was that lots of people smarter than me have been trying to define this term for a very long time, and nobody's come up with a real answer to it. I think at the end of the day, we know a rural place when we're in one, when we experience it. And that's part of the almost emotional or affective sense that I wanted to trade on, was that we see rural in this country as quiet, as largely empty, as slower paced. And so wherever you find yourself feeling that way, you would probably label that, I'm in the countryside now, I'm in a rural area.
No word has been used more consistently to describe rural America than crisis. Is that a fair word to use?
Well, that's where I started this project, because that's what I was reading in the newspapers, really starting from about 2015. There would be periodic stories about rural America in crisis. And at that point, what people were largely talking about was opioids. And before that, it was methamphetamines, and then, you know, kind of healthcare issues altogether. When I began to do the research, and as a historian, the first thing you do is you go backwards rather than forwards. And when I did that, what I discovered is that a variation of that word, crisis, decline, whatever you want, has been used to talk about rural America since the middle of the 19th century, and in virtually every decade between then and now, which then led me to wonder whether this was useful language at all. If we're always talking about crisis or decline or being left behind, or again, variations of those phrases, then is this really useful language at all? Because when, therefore, was rural America somehow good? When were we not talking about it in these terms? And it turns out we never really were.
So chronic might be a better word.
That's what I think. I think that what we have here, if you think about a crisis, what it implies is something that is abnormal, out of the ordinary, and which somehow resolves itself. It either gets better or we come to some sort of a new normal. And in that sense, I think the chronic condition that people have been complaining about, again, since the, you know, probably the third quarter of the 19th century, really forced me to think about a different way of trying to describe the dynamics in rural places around the country. It didn't seem to me that doing another rehash of, oh, gee, we're in crisis, was going to get us very far, because clearly it hasn't gotten us very far for 150 years.
And in your book, The Lies of the Land, you talk about Theodore Roosevelt's Country Life Commission.
Yes.
What was that, 1908?
1908. It's a wonderful little footnote in the Progressive Era. The first major agricultural crisis that kind of became a national topic of discussion was the so-called the original populist movement of the 1880s and 90s. And farmers were feeling squeezed one way and another, and this erupted into a political movement. It reached a crescendo in 1896. With that in mind, when he became president, Teddy Roosevelt decided to create this commission, presidential commission, to study and offer recommendations for what's going on in rural, mostly farm areas, mostly agricultural areas. That's what they really focused on. And they issued this report. The report is filled with the descriptions of what's happening in rural America, but what's implicit underneath all of this is that rural America isn't keeping up with urban America. And so here are a variety of recommendations so that country life will be just as good and rewarding as city life is. What we can deduce from that is that there was already a perception in the early 20th century that somehow urban life was accelerating faster, rural life was struggling to catch up. So that's a nice little moment in this ongoing discussion of somehow rural America being left behind.
And in some of the supporting evidence you use, in the 1930s, it was reported that over 2,200 Iowa towns had been found abandoned, and that there was a 50% drop in farms, in the number of farms, between 1950 and 1970.
Yeah. Again, when you sort of start to scratch the surface of all of this, what you discover is that there really are these measurable indices of decline and change that go way back. People were shocked when the census data of 1910 revealed that lots and lots of rural counties, especially again in that kind of agricultural midsection of the country, were losing population. During World War I, you know, there was a famous, I guess we would call it a pop song, what are you going to do to keep them down on the farm once they've seen Gay Paris? There was a sense that once these boys had left the farm and gotten a taste of big city life and gone overseas and what, they weren't going to come back. But people were already leaving. You roll through places like Kansas and Missouri, the Dakotas, and you can discover that some of these towns hit the peak of their population in the census of 1910, maybe 1920, and they've been on a slow, steady decline since. Lots of reasons for that. One of the major reasons is that what's happening simultaneously is that agriculture in this country is industrializing furiously. I think that's another of the misconceptions we carry with us, is that somehow agriculture is a older, simpler, form of economic life and industry, manufacturing and factories and all of that are somehow a modern form of life. But that's simply not the case in this country. Agriculture began to industrialize in all kinds of ways in the late 19th century. And as it did so, you could achieve economies of scale. You required fewer people to do exactly the same amount of work. And that meant surplus labor, which then left, let's say the Red River Valley in Minnesota and wound up going to the Twin Cities. This is the popular, and again, it begins very early in the 20th century. People begin to notice these patterns.
Stephen Kahn, what is your area of academics at the University of Miami in Ohio?
So I teach all kinds of American history courses. I sort of consider myself the utility infielder of our undergraduate curriculum. Whatever needs to get taught, I often teach. But as a specialist, one of my fields of interest is urban history. And I know it sounds almost perverse that as an urban historian, I wound up writing this book on rural America. But it really does come out of my work as an urban historian to sort of put on those lenses to look now at the areas beyond American cities and see what we can see using that framework.
Well, here are some statistics from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Census Bureau about rural America today. 97% of the U.S. is rural land. The population is about 46 million, which is 14% of the U.S. total. There's about 1.9 million farms in the U.S. The median worth of those farms is 1.4 million. Food and agriculture contribute about $1.4 trillion to the gross domestic product. One of the outstanding figures there for me, Professor Kahn, was 97% of the U.S. is considered rural?
Yeah. So this has to do with the way the census and other government agencies count the opposite of rural, which is to say, first, the Census Bureau counted urban. And then in the 1940s and 50s, it began to develop this notion of the metropolitan statistical area. And they've wrote that, I think it first appeared in 1949. It's been revised a bunch of times. The point of that is, though, anything that isn't defined as a metropolitan statistical area is ipso facto classed as rural. And in that sense, I think you put two of the statistics you just counted together, and I think you get a really interesting picture of the country right now. 97% of the area is classed as rural, but only 14% of the people who live there, which means, if I'm doing my math correctly, 85% live in 3% of the landmass of the United States. What we have seen, and this does begin almost from the very beginning of the United States, is a steady concentration of population. When the first census is counted, about 5% of Americans lived in an area classed as urban. And now by 2024, we're at 85%, give or take, of people living in these metropolitan statistical areas. That's an enormous concentration of population into relatively small areas.
Want to talk about some of the issues that have historically faced rural Americans and contemporary rural Americans. Let's begin with politics, populism. Wasn't there a movement at some point in the early 20th century called the Grange?
Oh, sure. Actually, that goes back to the 1870s. What farmers, you know, when the middle of the country opens up after the Civil War and the Homestead Act and the military campaigns against Native people kind of clear out that space and people establish their homestead farms, people are out there thinking of themselves as staking their claim to an economic future. What they discover, however, is that acting individually, they're struggling pretty mightily. So a number of these kinds of collective organizations begin to form to try to address the issues that face farmers as a group rather than as individuals. So the Grange begins in the 1870s. There are versions of this. You can still drive through the Midwest and see Grange Hall in some of these small towns. That then developed into a much larger political movement, which then created what was called the People's Party, or the Populists. And they first ran a candidate for president in 1892, and they were very successful at electing local officials, congresspeople, a couple of senators, and so forth, out of this revolt of farmers at their struggling economic conditions. And that's what, as I said, sort of culminated in 1896, and then that movement collapsed.
Did that populism lead to labor violence, to uprisings on farms?
No, I don't think it led to that sort of violence. What I would say, however, is that the demands that the populists made in their party platform in the 1890s, though the movement itself kind of evaporated, many of those demands wound up becoming national policy. For example, they were the first political party to call for the direct election of senators. Well, fast forward about 20 years, and we got the direct election of senators. They're the party that that first demands an income tax on wealthy industrialists. And fast forward, we get an income tax. So there is, I think, an influence that the populists had, in some cases, I think, quite dramatic influence, even though the political movement itself had evaporated and kind of died away.
In your view, are rural areas of America overrepresented in politics?
Oh, yeah, I don't think that's my view. I think that's a fairly wide consensus at this point. The rural, or what I might also call anti-urban bias in American life is baked into our political system, most obviously through the Senate and then its and the way the Electoral College works. The way I talk about this with my students is to talk about what I call the tyranny of Wyoming. Wyoming has fewer than, let's call it 700,000 people living in it. It gets two U.S. senators. The state of California has 38.5 million people living in it. It gets exactly two senators. Now, what that means, of course, is that your vote in a very rural place like Wyoming simply counts for more than it does. And your representation in the Senate is in some ways more direct than it is in a place with 38.5 million people. We can also see similar biases at the state level as well. And this has a lot to do with the way districts get drawn and have always been drawn. And so the kind of rural advantage in state houses has also been very, very significant over the years. But again, I think political scientists have done a much more thorough job of just counting all of that up than I have. I think that's a generally accepted fact of American political life.
And as we continue to look at some of the issues in rural America, some of the things that you bring up in The Lies of the Land include economic inefficiencies and lack of basic services.
Yeah, so rather than thinking about urban versus rural, and this is something I came to as I was working on this project, maybe it would make more sense, especially at the level of policy, if we began to think about this in terms of population density and think about it maybe almost as a sliding scale where you have, you know, San Francisco at one end and you have Wyoming at the other end. Because one of the things that you notice along the sliding scale is that the more dense your population is, the more efficient certain kinds of things become, certainly economically, but also in terms of public services, healthcare services, and so on and so forth. The problem for rural Americans, for many people in rural America right now, is that the population densities are low enough that they can't support the basic things that the rest of us all take for granted. You can drive through large parts of the Midwest, and what you discover is that the school systems have been consolidated into larger and larger areas because there aren't enough kids to support a school more locally. So this means kids are driving 45 minutes, 90 minutes each way in a bus to get to school. That's monstrously inefficient. You could look at the same thing in terms of hospital access, supermarket access. All of these things are a function of density. And then if we talked about it in those terms, we might want to sort of tally what are the costs and benefits of low density living. Clearly, if you want to have a healthcare system where rural people have the same kind of access as you do in a much denser area, that's going to have to be subsidized some way or another. The market system that we have now is not going to do that. So then we have to ask the question, is this sort of thing worth subsidizing? And if it is, we should subsidize it. But if we decide it isn't, it is just too inefficient, then we should be honest about that too.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So there is a sense of depopulation, of isolation, being left behind, as you say.
Yeah, well, as I said, I think that it's not that necessarily that people have been left behind in the economy altogether. It's that when you choose to live in a lightly populated area, that comes with certain almost unavoidable costs. And as I said, the hospital is going to be a long way away because the hospital needs a certain sort of population catchment in order to function. So that's, you know, people are in various ways, you know, struggling economically, but also not struggling economically. But they, even those who are doing well economically in rural places, are still paying a kind of an extra price for choosing to live in these low density environments.
Would you consider Oxford, Ohio, where Miami is located, a rural area?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of on the edge of the Cincinnati, the greater Cincinnati area. But it's a town of about 12 or 15,000 people. It's a university town, and all you have to do is maybe drive 3 minutes from the center of campus, maybe 5 minutes from the center of campus, and you will find yourself either in a cornfield or a soybean field because it's Ohio and that's pretty much all we grow. So yeah, it is a rural place.
Why are some of the reddest areas the most rural areas? Do you have a hypothesis?
Well, so yeah, there's the million-dollar question. I think that they're probably, and I'm no expert here, so I should, you know, I'm a historian. I have a hard enough time dealing with the past, so I'll say that as a caveat. I think that there are probably a couple of things that are going on. I think in a place like Ohio, those rural areas have, by and large, always voted Republican. And as a consequence, it's a habit. It's what my parents did. It's what my grandparents did. The Republican Party itself has become, you know, more and more extreme as it has floated off into its sort of right wing world. But these people are going to vote Republican regardless of the particular ideologies of the Republican candidate. I think there's a level of grievance or anger that you find in at least some pockets of rural America that has to do with some of what we were just discussing. When you think about the myth of the rural America, it's you know, it's real America after all. That's what Sarah Palin told us. It's home on the range where the skies are not cloudy all day, and it's supposed to be the virtuous, good American life. That's the mythology which we've had since Thomas Jefferson. But these people are living lives in which their employment opportunities are pretty restricted. They're right, the hospital is 45 minutes away or an hour away. There's not a decent supermarket anywhere nearby, so they're doing their grocery shopping at Dollar General. And I think this crash between the mythology of what rural life is supposed to be and the reality that people are experiencing has caused a fair bit of this anger.
Yes, we discovered your book in The New Yorker, in a book review in The New Yorker, which focused on Grant Wood's American Gothic. How does that play a role in your book?
Well, it's I wished I'd been able to put it on the cover of my book. So I was very happy that The New Yorker writer Daniel Immerwahr was able to do that for me. I think what he does wonderfully in that book is to take maybe the most iconic painting of the 20th century in America and really do an anatomy of it to reveal that what you think you are seeing here isn't really what you're seeing here. This is not a farmer and his wife. It's a dentist and somebody else. This house itself was built from a Sears catalog from Chicago. The house actually by this point had been abandoned. I mean, it's a wonderful job that he does in dissecting this mythology that we associate with that pastoral life, which again goes back deep into the 19th century. It's Jefferson's yeoman farmers, but it certainly continues to this day. One of the things that I was talking about in another talk that I gave, but I didn't include it in the book, was the phenomenon of Little House on the Prairie. The books were published in the 1930s. The television show was a rip-roaring success in the 1970s. And in both cases, what they do is perpetuate this mythology of the self-sufficient, independent farm family making it out on the frontier, none of which was actually ever true. It was not true for the Ingalls family themselves. It's that mythologizing which we still hang on to. And when people have to live these lives in rural places, or they choose to live these lives in rural places, it turns out it's not Little House on the Prairie. It's a lot different than that. And as I said, I think that contrast between the myth and the reality creates a lot of friction.
From your book, in essence, what many aggrieved rural people seem to want are the benefits of urban society without the density and diversity of urban living. Many Americans still project onto rural America their yearning for tight-knit community, for self-reliance and independence, neighborliness, and simpler, slower living. But that fantasy cannot accommodate the realities of life in many parts of rural America, nor does it take into account the thorough extent to which the military, industry, corporations, and suburbs have shaped rural space.
That's not bad. that's a nice summation of what I was getting at. That in fact, contra the kind of Currier and Ives mythology we have of the pastoral and the countryside and whatnot, rural people, rural places have always been enmeshed in these much larger forces shaping what we would call modern American life, starting with the military. One of the things that I would put to you, just as a way of maybe thinking about all of this, is that before we could even have a rural in this country, we had what at least white settlers saw as a wilderness. And the transformation of wilderness into rural, you know, that sort of wild, dangerous place into something domesticated and charming, that's accomplished first and foremost by the American military. Between 1790 and 1890, there are, by anybody's best count, there were more than 1,600 military clashes between federal or state National Guard troops and indigenous people. So it was not an empty space, right? That was all cleared out, and it was all done by the military. I did a chapter as well on some of the effects of the Army Corps of Engineers on rural landscapes and the way in which those dredging projects, canal projects in the 19th century, and then dam projects, flood control projects in the 20th century, made it possible to farm in those areas in the first place, those large-scale irrigation projects. So the military, yes, large corporations, yes. From the 1930s onwards, Congress, the presidency, is working pretty hard and consistently to try to industrialize country areas, because that's a way to create jobs for people who are no longer needed on the farm, because as we discussed a moment ago, you don't need that farm labor anymore. It's all been industrial. So what if we moved car factories or steel plants or whatever it happens to be out of Chicago, out of Detroit, and we moved them into the countryside? One of the things I discovered, much to my own surprise, is that a great deal of American automobile manufacturing now takes place in what we would call rural areas, especially the Japanese companies, Toyota and Honda, who built these plants starting in the 70s and 80s, not inside urban areas, but out in the cornfields. So rural people are not farmers, statistically speaking, much at all. They're factory workers. They're long-haul truck drivers. They're doing all of these things that are connected to our industrial society. So that's, yeah, I wanted to kind of look at rural America through those lenses to see what it looked like.
And those four lenses that Stephen Kahn uses in The Lies of the Land: militarization of rural America, industrialization, corporatization, and suburbanization. Let's spend a little time with each one of those, and let's start with the militarization. This is from your book, Professor Kahn. Using the power of Congress and the courts, the military displaced thousands of rural people in order to empty the space necessary to train troops, test weapons, and otherwise practice for war. The military transformation of rural space entailed radical changes to the social and economic ecology of these places, and equally dramatic changes to the land, water, and the rest of the natural ecosystem. You use Bell County, Texas.
Yes.
As an example. What is that?
Bell County, Texas became in about 1940, I could have that date off a little bit, the home of Camp Hood and then Fort Hood. And this is now, I think, the U.S. Army's single largest base by number of people. It might be Fort Bragg. They go back and forth. This was set up to prepare troops to fight in World War II, and especially to use artillery and tanks during World War II. It's scrub country. It sort of sits right on the edge of where kind of cotton and grain are grown, and then where you get into Texas ranching country, it's sort of right on that ecological line. Several hundred farm families are uprooted to create this space. And it exists to this day. What it looks like now, of course, is an army town where there's a steady population, but a constantly rotating population of mostly young men who now support a host of used car dealerships and pizza shops and bars and strip clubs and all the rest of this. So what was once a very quiet and small-scale farming area in this little pocket of Texas has become this sprawling operation whose economic life is entirely dependent on the base. One of the things that I wanted to do was to do in the book is to do a compare contrast between a place like Fort Hood, which is still there and operating, with a base which wound up closed in the 1990s when we did those. It was called the BRAC process, where bases were either closed or consolidated, realigned, a kind of post-Cold War effort. So I paired Fort Hood, Texas, with Camp Sawyer, with the Air Force Base on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And in some ways, the same thing happens. The base comes in, it's an economic boom. It's feeding tax revenues into the local municipalities, supporting the school systems, et cetera, but it's one of those bases that gets closed. And when it does get closed, that whole area on the Upper Peninsula just implodes economically. It had become a one-company town. And it just, I think, for me, underscores the extent to which lots and lots of rural communities are dependent, I say in the book, almost addicted to military spending. And without it, they have no economic viability at all.
And you quote author William Faulkner in 1956 as saying, "Our economy is no longer agricultural. Our economy is the federal government."
Yep. And that's a great quote from Faulkner, who was no fan of the federal government, but at least saw this pretty clearly. It is certainly the case when we're talking about the military that a disproportionate number of these large bases wound up in the American South. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. But essentially, this is something that begins right before the First World War and then is accelerated during the Second World War. When the Air Force begins to establish its own bases and then its missile installations, that's more broadly, it happens more broadly across the map. But those Army bases and Marine bases are disproportionately located in the South, making, and it's not just the bases themselves, right? It's everything else that the base generates economically. So maybe it's suppliers or defense contractors or all the other things that particular military installations are gonna need. So large portions of the American South are dependent on the federal government.
Stephen,
the irony, of course, is that many of them would resent the very statement that I just made.
Stephen Kahn, did you grow up in a rural area?
I did not. I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm a city kid, but I find myself now living in a very small town in the middle of rural Ohio, and I teach in a slightly larger town, also in Southwest Ohio. And so part of this book is an attempt for me to understand my own surroundings better. And I think it did that, but it does reflect an outsider's view, maybe, of what this is all about.
So what did you think of J.D. Vance's book, now Senator Vance's book, about rural Ohio?
Yeah, well, it for me, and I read it with a group of first-year students at Miami University. I think it's problematic in all kinds of ways. And I think one of the things that that we might accuse J.D. Vance of is a certain kind of misrepresentation. I think what he describes as his own family background does tell an important story. That is to say, the migration of people out of very rural pockets of Appalachia and into, in his case, a small city, Middletown, Ohio, looking for industrial work. That certainly did and does happen from the 1950s and 60s onward. The lessons he draws from all of that, I think, kind of, they miss a great deal. Let's just put it that way. It's a campaign promo more than a kind of honest reckoning with the issues at stake.
I want to show some video. A recent book that came out was called The Overlooked Americans. It was by Elizabeth Currid Halkett. She appeared on our Book TV network. Here's a portion of what she had to say.
I don't think they ever judged us in the first place. I don't think they ever did. I mean, you send my email out to these folks introducing myself. I'm doing this book. They see my signature. I'm a professor at USC in Los Angeles. They wrote me back anyway. And I would like to believe I would do the same. But I wonder, you know, would I immediately have my back up? I mean, now I wouldn't. I feel extremely changed by the work I did. But I think that's the thing we lose sight, that they are, the folks that I interviewed from rural America weren't judgmental from the get-go.
Any comment about what she had to say about the overlooked Americans?
Yeah, oh dear. I'm afraid at an individual level that might well be true. 10 years ago, I actually did an entire book, which I'm afraid would contradict her statement there. In fact, it has always been the case that urban America has been on the receiving end of all kinds of nasty judgments. Again, starting with Jefferson, who compared cities to cancers on the body, to Henry David Thoreau, and on it goes. It's simply, so let's return to a moment to J.D. Vance. During the senatorial campaign in 2022, he sent out a tweet. He was on his way to New York for a fundraiser. He was going to meet with a bunch of millionaires, though he didn't put that in the tweet. And he said, gee, everybody, I'm going to New York. I hear it's violent and disgusting. Any advice? That's simply typical of the anti-urban discourse that has been central to American politics since 1790. And there isn't a comparable discourse, as I'm afraid she seems to think there is. It is simply unacceptable to talk about rural Americans in the same derogatory, insulting way that politicians routinely describe American cities. And we've seen that just supercharged in the last couple of years. Look at the way people talk about San Francisco and New York and Chicago. And there is simply not a comparable discourse, not now and not across 250 years of American history. So I'm afraid she just has it wrong. I know that book. She found some nice people to talk to, and she made some conclusions that historically just don't stand up.
Well, along with militarization, Professor Stephen Kahn says industrialization has affected rural America. Quote, industry has always been part of the American pastoral, even if we have chosen not to see it. What do you mean?
Yeah. So, you know, the very first American industries, and now we're going way back. We're going back into the 18th century. The very first American industries, iron smelting, paper making, those kinds of things, were always located outside the city. And they were located basically near the resources that you needed to have to do those things. What happens in the 19th century, and especially in the late 19th century, is that industry centralizes into big cities like Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit. But then, almost immediately, there is a drive to try to, and this is the word that people use, to decentralize that, again, because of that anti-urban impulse that is so strong in our American culture. This people start to talk about this in the 1920s, and then the federal government under the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt really try to accelerate this process of moving factories and manufacturing jobs out of central cities and into the countryside, where these people need jobs, and so rather than have them move to Chicago, let's move the factory out to someplace in downstate Illinois. One of the ways that the federal government facilitates this is through the big projects of rural electrification. At the start of the New Deal, fewer than 10% of American households had electricity. That's another one of the differences between urban and rural life at that point. So by 1960, that's not true anymore. Almost all rural places have electricity thanks to the Rural Electrification Program, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and all the rest. But the real point of this was not simply to deliver electricity to your house. The real point of these was to make cheap electricity available to attract industrial production. And so that's part of why industry does begin to move into the Tennessee Valley area, because now you've got this cheap hydropower that's being generated, and now we can open up our factory there. And I would say that this is not, in the 20th century, a partisan issue. Franklin Roosevelt started it. Eisenhower accelerated it. Lyndon Johnson was all on board, and so was Richard Nixon. There's a kind of bipartisan sense that we should industrialize the countryside, frankly, at the expense of those places like Detroit and Cleveland, who are seeing those manufacturing operations leave in the same years.
Well, Stephen Kahn, you use a couple of examples. Number one, Lordstown, the GM plant in semi-rural Ohio, but there's also the Honda plant, which has been very successful in Marysville, Ohio.
Yep. And the Honda plant so let's back up two steps for viewers. Honda opened its first manufacturing plant in central Ohio in what was then a tiny little place called Marysville. And this was in the late 70s, and they started with motorcycles, and then they moved into automobiles. What Honda then also did was to create a kind of set of satellite supplier factories that feed into the central assembly plant in Marysville. And all of those places around Ohio are also in tiny locations. Honda really keeps Ohio as the second most important state in automobile manufacturing, but it is not an urban phenomenon anymore. It's a phenomenon of the countryside. And one of the things I discovered in doing the book is that Honda's engine plant is located in a town called Anna, A-N-A, Ohio. And there are more people that work at that plant on any given shift than actually live in that town. So these folks are coming from a rural hinterland. They work in this rurally located engine plant, and then they go home again. And that is indicative of the way our manufacturing has been decentralized, has been moved out into the countryside.
But Lordstown has not been so successful for GM, correct?
Right. The Lordstown story hit the national press, let's say in 2019 or 2020, when GM announced it was going to close this plant, and then it became a kind of symbol of a political football of one sort and another. I was really interested in the origins of this, which go back to the 1950s. Lordstown is one of the very first experiments that GM does in moving its manufacturing operations out of the Detroit area and into essentially a big cornfield. I mean, that's what's there in Lordstown when GM moves in. So that plant, kind of ran for about 50 years or 50 plus years before GM decided, it was no longer economically viable or efficient. But for me, Lordstown is a symbol of this post-war move of manufacturing out of urban areas and into rural areas.
Militarization, industrialization, corporatization, and this is a quote from your book, corporations control the seed that goes into the ground, the chemicals that saturate the soil, the equipment used to plant, spray, and harvest, the trucks that haul the product away, and the processing operations that turn the raw material into something profitable. What's the impact of corporatization on rural America?
Well, I think there are a couple of things at work here, the first of which, and that speaks to the agricultural economy. We think, again, we have this notion of a farmer, and let's go back to Grant Wood for a moment. There he is with his pitchfork and his bib overalls, and there's your American farmer. But in fact, the American farmer is and always has been deeply tangled up with these large-scale corporations which make his or her livelihood possible in the first place. The first of the biggies here are, let's say, McCormick, who are the first big manufacturing of these farm machines in a big plant in Chicago. And then after the Second World War, increasingly these chemical companies using, kind of the byproducts of petrochemical stuff for fertilizers and pesticides and whatnot. So everything about a farming operation now is connected to, or you could say squeezed by, these large-scale profit-seeking corporations, like Monsanto, though Monsanto doesn't exist anymore, and these large-scale seed companies and so forth. So right, let's just remember that farming is not quaint and charming in the way that we kind of want to think it is. It's absolutely a product of these large-scale corporations.
But would you say that corporate farming is more efficient than family farms?
So this is a great question, because if what you this is certainly what the Nixon administration felt when it Nixon administration wrote the first big farm bill in the early 1970s. And the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, Earl Butz, was famous for saying to farmers, get big or get out. He certainly believed, and the Nixon administration certainly believed, that the way forward for American agriculture was ever bigger, ever more efficient, larger pieces of equipment producing more yield per acre. That has worked wonderfully. There's no question that that has been a success. The flip side of that, it seems to me, is to ask questions, as plenty of people now are and have been doing, about what does this mean about our American food system? What exactly are we producing? It is largely carbohydrates in the form of grains and corn and soybeans, which are a form of protein, but soybeans get used for lots of other things too. But I think plenty of people have really important critiques to make about a corn and soy dependent agricultural system. And that's before you even get to the environmental consequences of Roundup and all the other sorts of things that get poured onto the soil. So it is efficient in doing the things it's efficient at doing it. Is it efficient at producing food that's nutritious? Not so much. It's not efficient, and here's another irony I discovered when I was doing the work. It's not efficient at actually feeding people in rural America. Some of the worst food deserts in this country are places surrounded by farm fields, but there's no actual food to eat that you can get in any accessible way, though there you are sitting in farm country. So it's not very good at doing that.
In your section on corporatization of rural America, you talk about Ward's, Penny's, Sears, Walmart. What impact have they had on rural America?
Yeah, so once again, I think we have a sentimental view of what Main Street is, and sometimes we like to draw this easy journalistic contrast between Main Street and Wall Street. In fact, Main Street was always Wall Street, and Wall Street was always Main Street. Companies like let's use Woolworths, which I write about in the book a little bit, became staples of American small towns. Woolworth deliberately, before he ever opened a store in a city, he built his empire by opening these five and dime stores in market towns, in the towns which served the outlying farm population. But the products that people were buying here, let's pretend we're in Nebraska for a moment, and we're in a small town there with a Woolworths, the products that you would buy on Saturday, you come in from your farm, are being made in Chicago, they're being made in Philadelphia, they're being imported from London. So through this, and Woolworths, of course, becomes an enormous corporation, builds at one point, when the Woolworth Tower gets built, it's the tallest building in the world in Lower Manhattan, all built on the nickels and dimes of rurally located people who are themselves connected to the consumer culture of the entire nation and indeed of the globe. That's what Walmart is as well. Right, for people nowadays, Woolworths has you know, sort of the sun has set on the Woolworth empire, but Walmart, when you go into Walmart, you are probably in a rural place. There's probably not another shopping opportunity for miles in any direction, but the stock you're looking at comes from China, it comes from Bangladesh, it comes from Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So rural people through these large corporations have always been connected to these international networks of commerce, consumerism, and trade.
Militarization, industrialization, corporatization, the fourth pillar that Stephen Kahn writes about in The Lies of the Land is suburbanization. Quote,
yep.
Suburban development is built on a basic irony. If those suburbanites who left the city were drawn by the promise of more space, less traffic, fewer people, lower crime rates, and all the rest, then many seemed resentful as their suburbs filled with more and more development.
There's a bumper sticker that I sort of quote in the book, which says, asphalt, it's the final crop. And I think that summarizes very nicely what happens it's the last step in a process of what's happened to American agriculture. By and large, I would say, you know, overwhelmingly, suburban developments as you see them are built on what was once agricultural land. And to take, you know, the kind of iconic symbol of this, the Levittowns built in New York and Philadelphia, those were all on farm fields. And that's sort of the model of suburban development. So what this means is that a farmer or many farmers has sold up and to a developer, cashed out, and then suburban development happens. What I was struck by is the way in which, on the one hand, this is economic prosperity, right? Farmer gets rich selling off this land. The little town that was struggling is now booming again because all of these new residents are moving into these developments. But people are grumbling about it at the same time. And I have examples of this that I dug up in the research that I did. It isn't what it used to be. We don't like these new people. We're the old timers. They're the newcomers. And they just don't understand culture. And you see this all the time. I looked at a place called Naperville, Illinois, which I think is kind of emblematic of all of this. So there is, I think, this kind of irony buried at the center of our suburban aspirations, that inevitably, if a suburb is successful, it just gets more and more crowded, which creates more of the things that we thought we were escaping in the first place. Suburbia has always promised connection to all of the goodies of urban life with all of the values of a rural life. And when you discover that you can't actually have it both ways, this, I think, helps explain why suburban growth has always moved further and further out in those concentric rings, because we're chasing a dream we're never going to catch.
Did you find proof that it was an urban exodus to the suburbs, or was there a rural exodus to
the
suburbs?
Thank you for that, because so it is, when you tell the story of suburban growth in the post-war period, if you're a historian like me and you got your freshman in that class, what you talk about is white flight, because you can look at the collapsing population of the big industrial centers. New York loses 1 million people in the 1970s. They're moving out to the suburbs, and that's all true enough. But when you drill down a little deeper, you discover that the numbers don't actually add up. Suburban growth is happening far faster than can be explained simply by the movement of people out of the central city. What I've discovered is that a lot of this growth is driven by rural people, again, leaving those areas that are no longer economically viable. They're not moving into the central city anymore. They're moving into that suburb outside the city. So they can get a job in a metropolitan area, but they're not actually a city dweller themselves. And I think this drives a lot of suburban growth, especially in the Midwest, in places like Chicago, the Twin Cities, which I looked at a little bit, and places like that.
Stephen Kahn, what's the premise of your book, The Lies of the Land, and what are the conclusions you've drawn about rural America?
So the premise of the book is that rural Americans have not been left behind. They have not been overlooked. When we look at this historically, what we see is that rural Americans have been at the front of the national parade as often as not. They are absolutely connected in the way that all of us are to the big forces of, let's call it, American modernity, large-scale corporations and industrialization and all the rest. What I hope people take away from this book is that we might want to figure out, we have cast urban and rural in a kind of political death struggle here, and maybe there's a different way to conceive of our shared common ground. And maybe looking at it that way, we can begin to develop some ideas that might get us past what I see as a kind of logjam in the way that we discuss all of this in the first place.
Is this a book written for academics? It's published by the University of Chicago Press.
Well, it is thoroughly and richly footnoted, if that's where you want to go. But I've had my own children read this book, and they are not academics, and they thought it was a pretty nice read. So I work pretty hard to make my work accessible to an interested reader, whether or not they have expertise or an academic background. So I hope readers would find this accessible and in some places really enjoyable.
And
there's many bits in this book, actually, that I think will cause people to chuckle.
And let's close with this quote from the book. I've come to believe that rural America really does reflect what the nation has become, just not in the ways we want to acknowledge, much less celebrate at the state fair. Look past the narcotic nostalgia and the political rhetoric, and it is easy enough to see that rural spaces reflect the work of most of the major forces that have shaped 20th century America. Stephen Kahn of the University of Miami, Ohio, is the author of this book, The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't. We appreciate your time here on C-SPAN.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
All Q&A programs are available on our website or as a podcast on our C-SPAN Now app.